Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Pamela Clark. Pamela is a certified parrot behaviour consultant through the IAABC, the International Association of Animal Behaviour Consultants. She has a uniquely successful approach to helping clients, using most positive, least intrusive behaviour change strategies, coupled with a compassionate nature, excellent communication skills, and a first-rate knowledge of what parrots need for both good physical and psychological health, which helps her lead caregivers into a successful resolution of behaviour problems. Pamela has lived with birds for 50 years. Her background of experience includes 16 years of work as an avian veterinary technician, the breeding of African grey parrots, training free flight birds and other behaviours, and many years of informal hands-on rehabilitation of surrendered parrots with behaviour problems. Organisations in the United States, Australia and Canada have hosted Pamela for her seminars and workshops. Her contributions to parrot-related magazines have been translated into several foreign languages, and her popular blog can be found at www.blogpamelaclarkonline.com. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Pamela Clark to the Animal Training Academy podcast show today. She's patiently waiting by. Pamela, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Your name has popped up numerous times throughout the years from highly respected people and mentors of mine. So I always knew that this day would come. And here we are. So it's fantastic to have you. Hey, let's dive straight into the first question today, Pamela. For the listeners, can you take us back to where you first got started? You've been looking after parrots for 50 years. Where did you first learn about positive reinforcement animal training, though? Can you tell us about that and share some stories from that time?
I sure can, Ryan. I was thinking back, and I think it was back in 2004 that I first learned about positive reinforcement training. Well before that, I had been reading articles and publications about behavior, but the early information that was published for parrot caregivers tended to use a lot of techniques like flooding and negative reinforcement, and I never felt very good about that advice. And then finally, Susan Friedman and Barbara Heidenreich both came on the scene and started publishing information for parrot caregivers. And it was like a huge relief, a huge sense of discovery. And I was very happy to find that information. And I've been using it ever since. I've been an avid student and am proud of the fact that I've actually taught applied behavior analysis with Susan Friedman at the Companion Animal Sciences Institute. And I've had numerous occasions to present alongside Barbara Heidenreich over the years as well.
And so 2004, take us back to 2004. You're there, you're reading all of this stuff, and suddenly you come across an online article, something from Susan Friedman, Barbara Heidenreich, and it just resonated with you?
It absolutely did. I think one of the first things that I heard about was Susan Friedman's course, Living and Learning with Parrots. And like you, I'm always looking for opportunities to sharpen the saw. And at that point in the parrot behavior community, there was a bit of a divide. There were individuals who were more comfortable, perhaps, with the older information, older ways of doing things. But I wanted to learn more. And I took that course and an entire world opened up for me. And then as far as being able to watch Barbara Heidenreich, I've been in a uniquely lucky position because I live at a place called Cockatoo Downs. I rent a little house from my friend Chris Shank, who has an entire flock of free-flying cockatoos. And many years ago, we started hosting parrot training retreats here on site for caregivers. And Barbara Heidenreich would come and spend 5 days. So I've had long stretches of time to talk to her, watch her train, and learn to emulate her style.
And so once you started to absorb this information and you got to see trainers in action, and have conversations with them and learn from them. Can you remember any one particular project that you worked on or one particular bird that you worked with that kind of sticks out in your mind? Can you share any stories from that time of just first starting to apply this information?
Sure. One of the first that I remember was during a training retreat, and we had a little African gray who was eating a seed diet. I say little because she was young, and she was not at all interested in food reinforcers. And Barbara Heidenreich and I, during lunch break, scavenged the property for anything that we might be able to use as a reinforcer to train her. And we found plastic holiday straws, bits of wild grass, rocks, and it was a lot of fun to work at using what would be termed secondary reinforcers in order to get a good training response from her.
And so what happened?
Oh, she learned targeting. We specifically were just working on targeting that session with her, and she was quite successful. Her favorite were the holiday straws with pumpkins on them that we had gotten from the dollar store.
So you taught her to target in order to get access to play with pumpkin-shaped straws?
That's correct. That's exactly right.
Oh, what a great way to learn about reinforcers at that time.
It really was. And then I would say the second thing that comes to mind is the thrill of teaching my flighted parrots a recall cue. You know, there had been quite a bit written about height dominance in the parrot world, and there were in practice some pretty forceful ways that were being used to get parrots to step up. And it was such a thrill to be released from the bondage of that type of thinking and to train using only positive reinforcement and to get to the point where my birds would fly to me from any place in the house. That today is still one of my biggest joys.
And so the picture was different in 2004. I can only imagine. I was at university at the time. But you're therefore implementing this stuff. And compared to 2019, the available information online was, I'm assuming, much less.
Oh, much more. Yes, very much so.
And so were you at that point sharing what you were doing online? Were you having conversations with the people that were saying, but no, Pamela, because that bird's above you and it's got height dominance?
I have been having that conversation ever since 2004. Yes, Ryan. You know, there are never any shortage of opportunities to have that conversation. And unfortunately, a lot of that old information is still lurking. I could go on social media at this point in time and read something about height dominance. So the switch to a difference in thinking, in my opinion, has been slow in coming. And it's a point of frustration for me. But all we can keep doing is putting the right information out there.
And so how did you manage it at the time? If you're kind of fresh to this information and you're applying it and you're seeing it because you have people coming and visiting you and doing workshops in that location.
Yes.
How did Pamela Clark internalize that those conversations and kind of being where you were and knowing what you knew in the culture that was 2004?
Well, communication is something with which I'm really fascinated. And so the challenge then, as it is today, is to get information across in a way that a light bulb goes on for the listener. And so I, of course, would refer back to the fact that this was science-based information. And I was able to explain in a very logical fashion to people that some of the information that had been previously dispensed as truth could not, in fact, be true. And I was able to cite scientific studies, scientific research, and to me, that is the bottom line in all of this.
Awesome. And so 2004, you learned this stuff. What, there's been 15 years since then. Fill us in on what's happened in the interim. Where did life take you next?
Oh, many places. Oh, my goodness. I still have my own consulting practice, and I stay pretty busy with consulting clients. I've also branched out into doing dog behavior work, especially with aggressive dogs. I really actually like working with fearful and aggressive animals. I think they need a real break and somebody who knows how to skillfully resolve those problems. When I'm able to, I contribute to IAABC by producing webinars for them and contributing articles to their journal. I'm also very excited to be involved in another project with Barbara Heidenreich. She and I and a couple of veterinarians are creating the avian educational model for the Fear Free organization so that veterinarians, their staff, and others who provide care to parrots will be able to do so in a much less forceful manner in the future. I publish a blog once a week, and a lot of that concerns training practices, relationships with parrots, and communication with them. I'm also producing a series of webinars at present, and I'm just putting the finishing touches on a book about companion parrots in flight. That, to me, is a subject about which I'm pretty passionate. And then Chris and I continue to put on workshops here. We put one on for veterinarians a couple of years ago, and then we just put one on for a local rescue group.
And so out of all of those things, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on now. But between 2004 and 2019, if there's, let's say, two things in that time period that have been as important to you, I don't know if I can say this, as meeting Dr. Susan Freeman and Barbara Heidenreich and kind of getting that information that you were searching for in 2004.
You can certainly say that. I would say the two that are most important to me are working on the Fear Free Project. It is largely volunteer, and I'm not getting anything monetarily out of it at this point in time. But having worked as a veterinary technician for avian and exotic vets for close to 17 years, it saddened me greatly to see the way in which procedures are accomplished to this day. And in order to provide force-free medical care to parrots in the future would be a very, very great gift to them as a population of companion pets. So that would be one. And then furthering the ideas about flight, companion parrots and flight. It is still widely accepted that parrots should have their wings clipped. And I see that as a terrible thing. I talked to a behavior consultant in Australia once, Jim McKendry, and he said, you know, if a dog gets out of the yard and bites the postman, we don't cut his legs off. Instead, we build a better fence. And I think it is high time that we realize that we need to modify the environment to fit the parrot rather than the other way around. And having just concluded a series of 6 blog posts about flight, that to me was a huge achievement.
I'm going to dig deeper, Pamela. I'm curious as to kind of what's happened in that interim between 2004 and 2019, because that's 15 years, and there's, I'm sure, yes, been some amazing stuff, and it's led you now to these really exciting projects, which I know the listeners of this show, especially the parrot people, are going to be really excited about, and the bird people in general, the Fear Free staff, and everyone else that's working with other species is very familiar with the fantastic work that's going on in that realm. In the parrot world, the conversation about free flight is ongoing, and many contributors, and we've got lots to share and lots of conversations to have. So this 15-year period, is it just been kind of just building experience, building knowledge? Has there been any pivotal moments in that time where kind of something's happened that's caused a shift in your approach or caused a shift in your thinking?
I would say that there have been two. And the first occurred when I was working as a veterinary technician, because I had the opportunity to study human communication skills. And I think at that point, my approach to people and helping them solve their behavior problems changed and brought me into a much more compassionate and empathic place. It certainly increased my ability to communicate at long distance, because unlike most dog trainers, I think most of my work is done at a distance. So I have clients all over the world. Right now I have a client in Jordan, I have a client in Norway. And then that led to learning how to teach clients to teach their parrots, or to teach them how to train their parrots. Right now, I have a client in Norway who contacted me. She was referred by Barbara Heidenreich. She just wanted to train her Indian ring-necked parrot. And at that point in time, she could not even get the bird to step up. The bird would just fly away from her. And now Doris, the ringneck parakeet, performs a wide number of behaviors. So I would say it has been, the pivotal moments have been learning just exactly what can be accomplished long distance.
And if you, because I know a lot of the listeners of this show have their own businesses, and more people, I would say, nearly daily are probably leveraging what's available to us in 2019 with the online platforms. So you talk about communication skills and talk about learning about how to do this stuff online. What do you find works best for you, and how do you help leverage what you've learned with communication skills and working with people online to really, like, where is that thinking and journey taking you?
Well, for years, I worked solely by telephone. And now I much prefer using the Zoom platform so that I can see clients. It also helps to facilitate working with clients around the world. Getting them to take videos of their birds and teaching them how to do that has helped quite a bit as well, so that I can see actually what's happening, especially when it comes to implementing what Jesus Reales Ruiz initially called constructional aggression treatment. I've been calling it constructional aversion treatment because I use it with a lot of parrots who are very fearful. And although it's a simple protocol to practice, many parrot caregivers have difficulty with it. So using video to watch their progress in that regard has been very helpful as well. And then also just understanding, I'm very fond of a resource called James Clear, the James Clear newsletter. He is an authority on habits and how to build good habits, how to create better communication skills. And in one of his newsletters, he talked about the Goldilocks rule, which is that animals, humans, and others do best when they are presented with a task that is just outside their level of difficulty. And I think early on, I used to heap way too much onto clients and expect them to be able to sort it out. I'm a very high-functioning person, and I just assumed they were high-functioning people. And that was a fallacy, of course, and a mistake that I made. And so I work to achieve that with clients. I help them to prioritize. At the end of every consultation, they have goals for 1 week. And then we talk again at the end of that week, and they have goals for the next week. And so just being able to learn how to motivate clients better has been very rewarding for me. Is that what you mean? That sort of thing?
I mean, whatever it is to you.
Well, that's what it is to me.
I'm trying to get inside the head of Pamela Clark and understand how she operates.
Well, how Pamela Clark operates is that I love parrots more than anything else in the world, and all birds, actually. I'm house-sitting right now, and I've figured out how to provide the geese at this little farm with more enrichment, and I could spend hours just watching them fool around with the things that I provide for them. And I want people to see about birds what I see about birds. You know, many people are drawn to birds. They are drawn to their uniquely social nature and their intelligence and their beautiful colors. But I think that a lot of people miss the true essence of what a bird is. That's why flight is so important to me. And so my biggest joy in life is helping my clients and others to see birds the way that I see them, and to, as an extension of that, provide them with more liberty, more control over their lives, more enrichment in their life. That's what causes me to walk the walk these days.
And is that something you've thought about before? Is that kind of something you go into a consult and with in your mind? Like, my job here is to make these people see birds the way that I see birds? Or have you just articulated that for us now on the show? Or is that part of how you think?
No, that is always part of every consultation that I do. The majority of people come to me thinking that the parrot is the problem. And that always saddens my heart, because parrots are perfect the way they are. And the majority of behavior problems are created through two parallel tracks of reality. And the first is that the birds are not being provided with the optimal diet and environment and learning opportunities and all of that. And then at the same time, they also suffer from a lack of guidance. And so I go into every consultation thinking, how am I going to help this caregiver develop some more compassion for their parrot, and therefore become motivated to spend the money and the time that are often needed in order to create the changes that will solve the problem?
So step one is developing, is working towards the client developing compassion. Is that what you said?
Yes. Yeah. Most of the time it really is. All they know is they want that bird to quit biting them, and they want that bird to quit screaming. They want to be able to talk on the telephone without the bird screaming. And they are supremely focused upon what they want that bird to stop doing. And that's totally valid. I get that. And we will get there through our behavior change program. But they first must understand that it is often we who create those behavior problems, and therefore the solutions rest with them. And that is often not exactly happy news for them when they receive that. And, you know, you cannot, you can't achieve resolution of a behavior problem unless you can get that client to understand that reality and feel a bit more compassion for their parrot, that it's not the bird's fault, and that they are a social system, and that balance has to be achieved within that social system so that everybody gets their rights, not just the people and not just the parrot.
Cool. And we hope to, in the rest of this podcast, unpack a little bit even more how you go about doing this. But we'll move on to a list that you've created for the listeners of the show today. And thank you so much for sharing all of that. We call that part of the show the People's Behavior Odyssey part. So thanks for sharing your odyssey with us, Pamela. We appreciate that. So your parrot consultant, we've been talking about this. You've just shared with us a little bit about your mindset going into a consult and kind of how you feel the clients, the vast majority of the clients are perceiving their situations with their parrot, their animals. So you've come up with a list of 10 things you feel people in your role, and we can generalize some of these, I'm sure, to other species, but 10 things parrot consultants specifically need to know in 2019. One more time. Pamela Clark's 10 things parrot consultants need to know in 2009. Can you share this list with us, Pamela?
I sure can. You want me to just list all 10 right out the gate?
Do whatever feels natural. Yeah, list all 10. That sounds actually like a good idea, and then we can go through and break down each one individually.
Sure, sure. Okay. So number one, you know, I had a hard time deciding between numbers 1, 2, and 3, but I had to put as number one the best methods, you know, knowing how to really communicate well with clients and how to motivate them as well. Because if you can't do that, it doesn't matter how good you are at training or how well you understand applied behavior analysis and how to apply that to problems. So that would be number one. Number two is having a very good working knowledge of applied behavior analysis. Number three I listed was knowledge of how to train specific behaviors using positive reinforcement. Number four, understanding how to resolve fear in companion parrots. Number five, understanding how to resolve feather damaging behaviors and self-mutilation. Number six is how to convert a parrot, both small and large, from a poor diet to a good one. Number seven is understanding the triggers for the increased production of reproductive hormones and how to mediate those. Number eight, understanding the benefits of full flight to parrots and how to know when a parrot is a good choice for flight, assuming the owner wants to stop clipping wings. Number nine, understanding the environment that's necessary in which to keep a flighted parrot and how to train that bird as well. And finally, number 10, knowing how to teach parrots to forage and interact with enrichment.
So out of all of those, this is really interesting to me, and I like it a lot. And so I'm curious to go all the way back to number one, because, I mean, there are some significant and beefy pet parrot challenges in there.
Yes.
But number one you chose over and above all of the rest is not to do so much with the parrots, it's to do with the humans.
Absolutely. You know, when I was working as a veterinary technician, I had a lot of responsibility, and I did do the interviewing and hiring and discharging for the first clinic at which I worked. And I was there for a long time, about 13 years. And so many times people who were applying for work as an assistant or a technician would come in and they would say, I just want to work with animals. And I'm sure they thought that that was making a good impression on me. And in reality, it was just the opposite, because whether you're working as a veterinary technician or a behavior consultant, you are working most with the people. And if you want to help that animal, you can't do it without getting that human on board and helping them to help their animal.
So for, no, this is definitely one that doesn't just apply to pet parrot consultants. This applies to everyone on planet Earth. What are your suggestions for people in our industry in consultancy roles that are working with clients in behavior? What are some things we can do to sharpen our saws when it comes to communication? What recommendations can you share with the podcast listeners?
Well, I would say, first of all, in the very beginning, use a really good intake form. This is no area to just create something simple. On my intake form, I ask the same questions numerous ways. And I ask a lot of open-ended questions like, what were your favorite moments with your parrot this week? What was your worst moment with your parrot this week? Those sorts of things help you to gain access to the flavor of that relationship that the human has with the parrot, so that you can better target the manner in which you speak to that individual. And then I think, you know, I read once a long time ago that you can't teach anybody anything unless you have a good rapport. And so beginning with that first intake form and then continuing on when I talk to them, I am seeking always, watching their body language especially and their facial expressions, the tiny little cues that they give me as to whether they are enjoying the conversation, whether they're in the game with me, or whether I'm losing them. And then I think practicing respect and empathy, I just don't think that there is any room in our training and behavior world for feeling judgmental You know, I'm a firm believer that we should not speak ill of our peers, and we definitely should not speak ill of our clients. And I see too much of that online as it is. I think we've got to always maintain this attitude of empathy and respect towards our clients. That does not ignore the fact that sometimes there will be people with whom you work who can create some frustration in you. And so one of the things that I do is something I call a before contact check-in practice, in that I may not want to talk to that client. That's just reality at that point in time when I have an appointment. But I go and I sit and I have a few minutes of meditation. And I just think about what it's like to be in that person's shoes. And I think about how I don't know what's been happening for them. They might have had a personal crisis. I can't know. And it puts me right into that correct frame of mind to respond to them in a very effective manner. And then I think also we need to, just like we talk a lot about keeping animals in the game, making sure that they stay eager and ready to train. And then we also talk a lot about the fact that when we train an animal, if they're not learning, then we need to look at our training methods. And I think those two principles hold true just as well for clients, in that we need to think about how to keep each and every client in the game. How do they learn best? I will often ask clients this: do you prefer to hear things or do you prefer to read things? I pretty much ignore their answer after that, because I provide both an audio recording and a written summary. But I need to know that information about them. And then if a client is not doing well, if they are not doing what we have agreed they will do, I need to figure out what it is. Is there something wrong with my approach, or have things changed for them? And then I suppose that leads me to the next point, which is that I think we do need to hold clients accountable and learn to address a lack of compliance with diplomacy and curiosity and effectiveness to figure out, well, where really do we want to go from here? And I guess last I would say, well, one more thing. Some people have cognitive challenges, and we need to speak to the client in front of us. And then I guess lastly, I would say, remember to use positive reinforcement with your client too. They need it, because it's not easy for parrot owners to change their parrot's behavior.
Well, I think we have a whole episode there just in that one conversation.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. Yes. It's good. It's better to have way too much. I mean, I think we could make a whole podcast show on some of the things you shared.
Sure. Well, it is one of my passions for sure.
How to gain access to the flavor of the relationship so you have a good intake form. And that you have a bit of meditation at the start there to ask what it's like to be in that person's shoes, and remind yourself that you don't know what's going on in that person's daily life or life in general at that point in time. Some real gems there to take away for the listeners of the show. So thank you very much, Pamela. Number two is something that I have a big passion about for those that listen to this show and are members of ATA. You know this all too well. Yeah. But that's developing a working knowledge of ABA. So this is, you're talking about now the people actually with the consultancy shoes on.
Yes.
So once again, we're not even talking about the parrot working directly with parrots in this second most important thing parrot consultants need to know in 2019 thing. It's just working on your own saw and sharpening your own saw and getting that good knowledge. So what can you share with the listeners of this show? How can we continue to develop a working knowledge of ABA?
Well, using it primarily. I mean, I think in the beginning, it was the best thing I ever did to take Susan Friedman's Living and Learning with Parrots course. And of course, she still offers the Living and Learning with Animals course. And I guess I would say about ABA is that you can never get too much of it. You can never have too many occasions to listen to a presenter about it. It is such a complex and deep subject. And then I would say that teaching it, you know, I think it has often been said that to really know a subject, you should teach it. Now, early on, I made the mistake of, I was so excited about ABA myself, I thought all my clients would want to know about it. And that's where good communication skills come in, because not so much. I realized as I would see their eyes roll back in their head, that was way too much information for my clients. Sometimes, if a client is particularly interested in behavior, I will explain much later in the consultation about the science behind the recommendations I've been making. But I would say to anybody, you know, take Susan's course once, twice, three times, read Paul Chance's book, First Course in Applied Behavior Analysis, Companion Animal Sciences Institute teaches courses in ABA, and just take advantage of every opportunity to learn and apply this.
You are preaching to the choir there, I think, with the listeners
of
this
show. Yes,
of course,
I realize.
But it's always great to hear it, and some great references and learning opportunity organizations and courses there. So thank you for sharing those. Number three was and the most important thing parrot consultants need to know in 2019. Once again, I think this one is one that can be generalized to consultants working with other species as well. And that is how to train specific behaviors. Why did you choose that as number three?
Because it always seems incongruous to me that when most people, the vast majority of people, if they adopt a dog, they do so with the expectation that they're going to need to provide that dog with some training so that it can learn some basic behaviors. However, people have no such expectation at all when they adopt a parrot. And it is that very lack of guidance that causes that parrot to misbehave so many times. I mean, we know that animals have a drive to operate on the environment. And in the lack of appropriate guidance, you know, given the lack of positive reinforcement that occurs in the majority of parrot-human homes, these birds instead are being reinforced for screaming and biting and getting down on the floor and chewing woodwork and misbehaving in a variety of different ways. So we've got to be able to train caregivers how to train their parrots. And we have to be able to do this at long distance as well. It's great if we can have in-home consultations, but many of us live in areas where parrot owners are pretty few and far between. And so I think that getting experience in two different ways, not only training your own birds and other animals, I think it's really important that as parrot consultants, we train other animals. We train dogs and horses. And so we learn to generalize that training knowledge. And then also that we coach others in person on how to train those behaviors. That has really helped me. When we have had these training retreats here, I have been one of the coaches. So we would typically have people come from all over the United States and they would bring their parrots and we would coach them on how to train others. And that gives you an excellent understanding of how difficult it can be for people. You know, I think some of us are quick studies when it comes to training. We have good hand-eye coordination. We have a good spatial knowledge of where our body is in time, but many people lack that. And without actually seeing that happen in front of you, you miss a piece of how to help caregivers when you're working at long distance.
Awesome input. Thanks so much for that, Pamela. Number four is once again something that is generalizable to all species, and that is how to resolve fear. So what can you share with us about the fourth on your list of top 10 things parrot consultants need to know in 2019, how to resolve fear? Why have you chosen this as number four?
I chose this as number four because both four and five, resolving fear in companion parrots and resolving feather damaging behaviors and self-mutilation, are areas where we need to use applied behavior analysis, but where we need knowledge over and above that. So in terms of resolving fear, we need to have a good understanding of the sorts of things that cause fear in companion parrots. Those will be very different, very unique to parrots than they are to other other animals. And that, knowing that, having that knowledge then enables us to ask the right questions of caregivers, like, have you just polished your nails? Have you put a brand new picture up on the wall somewhere? These are all things that can be pretty terrifying to a companion parrot. And in my experience, certain species have a greater likelihood of developing fear reactions as adults if they are not well raised when they are young. And so we need to know how to guide the client into modifying the environment to reduce whatever stressors or triggers for fear responses exist in that environment. And then we need, of course, to be skillful in using desensitization and counterconditioning, but we also need to be able to use that CAT protocol that I mentioned earlier, constructional aversion treatment, in order to help those birds. Before I discovered that protocol, I made very slow progress in many cases, and it was hard to keep clients motivated. This is an especially painful problem for parrot owners in that they may have a bird that was previously very friendly to them and with whom they had quite loving interactions, and now suddenly this bird is terrified of them. When they approach the cage, it flips on its back and screams in what we can assume is terror, perhaps. And it is very hard to keep those clients in the game when they do not see progress being made very quickly. And I've had much greater success once I started using that particular protocol with fearful birds.
In the interest of time, we want to unpack what constructional aversion treatment is to you. But we've only got this one episode. So in five words, no, I'm just joking. But can you quickly run us through the basic premise of constructional aversion treatment?
Yes, the basic premise of this is, it lies in its name. The word constructional is used because you assist the animal in developing responses that are not fearful. And once you are done with that protocol, it is very common for that animal to have completely revised its opinion, if we can use that word, of the stimulus that initially caused such a fearful response.
Beautiful. All right. So that's another piece of content we now have to make with Pamela Clark, because we're going to move on to number five. So number one, knowing how to really communicate well with your clients. Number two, having a very good working knowledge of ABA. Number three, how to train specific behaviors. Number four, how to resolve fear. Number five is understanding how to resolve feather damage. So self-mutilation type behaviors, which is very common in parrots, isn't it?
It is common in parrots, and this is a big one for me. I have some frustration currently because I see many people helping parrots who have a good background in applied behavior analysis, and they are good trainers, and they are trying to address this problem solely through those methods, and it doesn't work. It simply doesn't. Because this is a very complex problem. Usually there are multiple things in that bird's life, multiple risk factors present that have sort of pushed that parrot over the edge into developing this behavior. And so you've got to have a good idea of what parrots really need in captivity so that you can identify those risk factors and lead that client into a resolution of those. And then you also need to understand which parrots you can help and which you can't, and be able to give accurate prognoses to clients so that they have realistic expectations.
So let's just stay on this point for a little bit longer. What are some of the risk factors involved? Like, when you go into a parrot consultant with a new client and this particular bird is doing a bit of feather damage, what are like the first pieces of information you try to find out?
Diet is a big one. Parrots that are eating a high-fat, high-carbohydrate diet often are at risk for this problem. Parrots who don't get regular bathing opportunities, birds who don't get out of their cages often enough, I do believe that living with clipped wings and having no ability to move around is a big risk factor. And these are all based upon my anecdotal experience. There has been very little scientific research done. The studies that have been done with very small populations. A lack of enrichment has been verified scientifically. I believe that inability to have access to fresh air and sunshine is another. And I think about this a lot, Ryan, and I used to think in these terms, but now I tend to think in broader terms, which perhaps is not as helpful when I am addressing a particular bird's needs, because I do need to be specific in those circumstances. But if we harken back to the need to give clients a window into their bird's world so that they can have a little more empathy, I have begun to think that it is just simply a lack of ability to perform natural behaviors that is a risk factor for feather destructive behavior. Because if you think about it, the way that we keep parrots is crazy. I mean, if we kept a dog in a small crate all the time and it only got out for 2 to 3 hours a day, that could be termed abuse amongst many people. But that's just normal for a lot of companion parrots. We clip their wings so they can't fly. They live indoors all the time. I mean, why don't they all feather pick when we look at it from that point of view?
Yeah, I hadn't had it explained to me like that before, but that makes a lot of sense. And so one part of your intervention might be to change the diets. And number six on your list was how to convert parrots between different diets. So let's say you've gone into a consultancy, you've seen a bit of feather damage, ancestral a lot of feather damage. You've gone through some of those things you just talked to us about, one of them being diet, and you wanted to change the diet of this individual bird. What would you do next? How would you convert? And remind us exactly what you said for number six. I've made some quick notes here, but I kind of butchered that one a little bit. So,
yeah, sure. I just said the ability to convert a parrot from a high-fat, high-carbohydrate diet to another one. And this actually, you know, we could probably talk about number seven and six at the same time. Number seven is understanding the triggers for the increased production of reproductive hormones and how to mediate them. Again, living with parrots is a unique experience because there is currently no safe way to neuter them en masse the way that there is for dogs and cats. So all parrot owners at some point or another deal with sexual behavior on the part of their parrots. And veterinarians generally agree that there are certain triggers for the increased production of reproductive hormones that exist in the wild, and that these triggers are not present continually in the wild. However, parrots are very good. You know, they have this drive to reproduce, and they are geniuses at teaching humans to provide them with the triggers for increased hormone production that were they able would lead to breeding and rearing young. And the first one of those is a diet that is high in fats and carbohydrates. So it's very typical for birds to be eating seed diets, as well as to have those seed diets supplemented with things like pizza, french fries, potato chips, and things like that. The problem with those foods is that they provide increased energy to the birds, so they can result in increased screaming, increased aggression, and I believe certainly it is a risk factor for feather damaging behavior, as well as contributing to malnutrition and several chronic disease processes. And you know, right now, I think that the whole topic of diet in companion parrots is a bit of a mess because no one can agree on the best diet for them. However, I think that we need to partner with our veterinarians. The majority of veterinarians have great anecdotal experience, and they are recommending that parrots eat formulated diets, namely pellets, but there are some other formulated foods as well, as the staple in the diet, and then these can be supplemented with fresh vegetables and limited fruit. So that is my approach, and it has been highly successful. And I just try and stay out of all the other diet arguments that are out there. So it would be true for both small birds and big birds that they would be converted primarily from seed mixes to formulated foods supplemented with others that contain enzymes, phytonutrients, and essential fatty acids.
Super helpful information and generalizable with regards to thinking about that to other species as well, just about what we're feeding our animals and how that affects behavior. Number eight is another huge conversation in the pet parrot world, and that is, well, it incorporates and encompasses clipping wings, and it also encompasses people who want to take their birds out and free flight them. And so number eight for you was talking about free flight parrots and when it's a good choice for an individual animal. Can you unpack this one for us?
I certainly can. And I just want to be very nitpicky about verbiage here. So a free-flighted parrot is a parrot who flies outdoors in an unrestrained fashion. And I am not talking about free flight. I'm talking about fully flighted parrots who fly within the home, whose wings are not trimmed, and who choose to use flight as their primary means of locomotion. So, you know, there are, boy, this would be the subject for another whole podcast. I did do a series of blog posts about this. If listeners are interested, they can find it at the blog website that you referenced early on in this. But mainly, I mean, the best candidates, of course, are those parrots who've never had their wings clipped. And then there are others who tend to regain flight more easily. Those would be birds with long tails. They're known as light-bodied birds. Birds who've only been clipped for 1 or 2 years. Cockatoos, small cockatoos, tend to regain flight more easily because their wingspans are slightly bigger in relation to their body weight and size. Probably the worst candidates for regaining flight would be the heavy-bodied birds, and Amazon parrots, African greys are a good example, who've been clipped for 8 years or longer. For one thing, those birds have pretty much lost their desire to go anyplace at will. They have become reliant upon the caregiver to move them from place to place. But secondly, it's tough to get them to fly. It's tough to motivate them to do so because it's too much work. It's no fun. There's nothing reinforcing for that bird about flying. And many of them are overweight by that time as well.
And number nine is, you're going to have to fill in my butchery of this one.
Sure.
Understanding the environment.
Yes. You know, once a bird can go wherever it wants, it is going to choose to perch on some of the highest places in your home. So typically that would be your refrigerator, your bookcases, the tops of your doors, your ceiling light fixtures, your ceiling fans. And if you don't want to have to replace your refrigerator gasket on an annual basis or your ceiling fan blades, then it is critical that you provide that bird with what I think of as furniture of his own. Plenty of hanging perches, play stands, tabletop perches, and then you've got to teach that bird to station so that it becomes most reinforcing for him to use those perches that you have provided for him.
Makes a lot of sense. And we're up to number 10 now. And so it's another environmental consideration, really, and that's making sure that their environments are enriching and specifically focusing on activities to make that so. So can you talk about the importance, the 10th most important thing that you have chosen for pet parrot consultants in 2019? And once again, I was quickly writing these down as you were saying them, so unbutcher my butcheredness, knowing how to enrich the birds.
Well, I labeled number 10 specifically as how to teach parrots how to forage. There is a general misunderstanding that I see embraced widely amongst caregivers in that they just think that anything you hang in the cage is going to be enriching to a parrot. And if the parrot doesn't interact with that item, they see it as a personality problem in the parrot. But what parrots do is they spend hours foraging for food in the wild. And the lack of this behavior in captivity has actually been linked to oral stereotypies. For instance, some birds, some cockatoos, even though birds don't have saliva, some cockatoos will generate a mucusy type of substance in their mouths, and they will open and close their beaks repeatedly to play with this substance. That is a good example of an oral stereotypy, and that has been linked to a lack of foraging opportunities in captivity. And the problem is that parrots are taught to forage, of course, by their parents in the wild. And most breeders and people in a bird's first homes don't understand this whole process and don't provide enough opportunities for the bird to learn this essential skill. So getting to the point where you can teach a bird this behavior later on is a bit tricky. It certainly can be done. Sometimes you have to get past the typical neophobic behavior that parrots will display, and then actually teach that bird the concept that food can be hidden.
Once again, something that's generalizable to other species as well. But a big challenge for pet parrots who are living in our homes and in ways that you described earlier in this podcast. So let's do a quick recap, and then we'll ask you for final words on this list before we head to the final question for this episode. Number one was knowing how to really communicate well with clients. Number two, having a very good working knowledge of applied behavior analysis. Number three, how to train specific behaviors. Number four, how to resolve fear. Number five, understanding how to resolve feather damage behavioral challenges. Number six, how to convert a parrot from a high-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, which leads into number seven, knowing and understanding triggers for increased production of hormones. Number eight is talking about fully flighted parrots, not free flight, that fly within your home. And when a parrot is a good candidate for that or not. And number nine, understanding the environment, how to set your house up to have a fully flighted parrot. And number 10 is how to teach parrots how to forage. Did I do a good job there? How did I go?
You did a wonderful job. Yes, sir.
And final words on this list, final words for listeners of this show, and I want you to speak now to the pet parrot consultants, but also to us working in the industry at large, working with animals in large and being consultants. What are your final words for us in that role in 2019?
As in the animal training world, are you talking specifically about the parrot behavior world?
Both.
Both. Well, of course, given my enthusiasms as expressed already, I'd like to see a change in practices regarding wing clipping. It is now illegal to clip wings in some European countries, and I would like to see that. I'd like to see us moving in that direction. I'd also like some recognition of the damage done to both babies and parent birds when baby parrots are removed for hand feeding. Third, a much greater understanding of the need that parrots have for liberty and control in their lives. And I would certainly generalize this. I think that we are a long ways from being good caregivers with all species when it comes to examining and learning how to provide them with control over the choices that they may have available to them. I'd like to see a recognition that outdoor aviaries for parrots are essential. And a general knowledge, and this one can certainly be generalized to other species, I'd like caregivers to have a knowledge of how to prevent behavior problems in the first place. Just, you know, that one piece about how their social reactions can influence behavior, if nothing else.
Lots to take away from today's episode to help us fulfill Pamela Clark's vision for the future for pet parrot consultants, owners, and consultants of other species as well. Pamela, you've become quite active online over the last wee bit, haven't you? And you've been very prolific in your writing and getting your blog going. So we've already said it at the start of this show, but can you tell the listeners of the show where they can go to read your blog? You've mentioned some of the articles in today's episode. Find out more about what you're up to. You said you've got some upcoming web classes and how they can get in touch with you.
Absolutely. They can always find the blog at my website, which is simply PamelaClarkOnline.com. The address for the blog itself is blog.PamelaClarkOnline.com. And then I have a couple of Facebook pages, one under my personal name and another that is called The Parrot Steward. And so they can find me any place there. I do publish the blog on Facebook as well and on LinkedIn and Twitter.
Fantastic. And we will link to all of that in the show notes for you listening so you can easily navigate to those areas from the Animal Training Academy website. Pamela, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming and spending time to hang out with us today at Animal Training Academy. We really appreciate it.
I think the thanks is mine, Ryan. I have enjoyed it more than I can say, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
We are working in slightly different roles, but we're singing the same song. So
that's certainly the truth, yes.
It's wonderful to have you here today, and everyone else as well. It's wonderful to have you here today. Thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate you. If you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our parrots and our other species in the most positive, fun, choice-rich ways, and as mentioned at the start of the episode, the ATA Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone. We're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.